And our next call for our next case, this is case number 57582. We have Mario Alberto Herrada Gonzalez versus the state of Nevada. Mr. Reed representing the appellant, Mr. McDonald representing the respondent. Ms. Lemke, I see, is here as co-counsel with you on behalf of the appellant. Mr. Reed, we have a lot of issues here in this case, interesting issues, which we scheduled for argument. Perhaps maybe both sides could focus on two things, the sufficiency of the evidence on the robbery conviction and the rebuttal argument on the allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, specifically the application of the Valdez case, and how you feel that affects the facts of this case. With that in mind, we proceed.
The case is honorable. Justices, I actually wasn't sure exactly where the court wanted to go with these issues, so I will obviously adjust my argument in accordance.
Well, you mentioned everything, but I just said we have some interest in those particular issues.
Then I would ask to focus then first on the sufficiency of the evidence of the robbery. Mm-hmm. I think what the court has to keep in mind is that in the context of the facts of this case, there is no clarity as to exactly how the robbery goes down or what is taken. What we do know from the crime scene as far as the facts are concerned is that the decedent had his wallet in his back pocket, he had money on his presence, and it was not this rabbit ear where you pull out the pockets like the pockets had been rifled through, which led the people that were investigating the scenes initially to conclude that there was no actual taking from this person. But what we do know is that the cell phone was missing. And so the cell phone was missing because there was a pocket, a holder of the cell phone that was open. And later on, the investigations concluded that Mario had admitted to actually calling the voicemail and had actually had the phone in his presence and later discarded it. So then I guess the real issue comes before this court is twofold. Is that even absent Mr. Herrada Gonzalez's statements to that fact, is there conclusive evidence that the phone was taken? Because I'd submit to the court that there is no evidence of any actual taking of money. And secondarily, is it an after-the-fact taking? And based on the verdict of the jury, I would think that the conclusion of the court would be that it was an after-the-fact taking under Ney. Because the jury's verdict was puzzling in this regard. They did not find Mr. Herrada Gonzalez guilty under an aiding, abetting, or conspiracy theory. Those charges were found to be not guilty. And, of course, the puzzling part about that aspect of the case is, as the court is aware, Mr. Herrada Gonzalez's explanations as to how it took place were that he was going to go over to kick his ass, and those were his actual words, and there was a dispute over the money that might have been owed to him, and he had been calling him all day and he was disrespecting him. But the only actual evidence presented is, again, my client's words, and my client's words were that Spooky and Shorty went over there to scare or intimidate him. He hears gunshots, they run back to the car, and then it gets very fuzzy as to exactly what takes place in terms of him either having money or the phone. I think the court can come to a conclusion that the phone was taken. How exactly, we don't know. But the phone was possessed by Herrada Gonzalez, I think we have to concede, based on the facts that there are voicemail messages that were made. But what we don't know is any of that evidence, absent the corpus issue, which is that Mr. Herrada Gonzalez is the one who provided those facts. So I hope I've satisfied the court in terms of the sufficiency of evidence on the robbery.
Okay.
And the other issue that the court wanted to address, I'm sorry.
What was the rebuttal argument of the state regarding various statements which were made by the prosecutor and how you feel the Valdez case is implicated by those statements?
And I would add to that the use of the term prey and predator in the state's argument.
Thank you, Justices, for clarifying that. Well, as we addressed in the briefs, there's numerous instances of misconduct. I think that the court should look at them cumulatively. I can't say for certain that every objection that I made was sustained, but I can tell the court I'm sure that a number of them were sustained. And in those two areas, and I hope I'm answering the court's questions, I think the biggest problems were not only calling him a predator or a prey or making any derogatory references, which would be more in the area of a penalty type issue than a trial issue, but also that there was an undermining of defense counsel's position. We objected to that, was sustained, but all that happened is in the rebuttal argument, the prosecutor then just changed it and repeated it again, but words to the effect of that, our defense was ridiculous, our arguments were untenable. And in light of the fact that we made a mistrial and that the objections were sustained, then this court has to go, I believe, to looking at whether or not there was sufficient evidence, and of course I believe I've also addressed that. If I could tie that into one other aspect of the case in terms of the sufficiency of evidence, which is on the murder charge itself, I don't believe this court can have confidence in exactly what the jury found in terms of the legal theory in which they convicted Mr. Gonzalez for first-degree murder, if I can elaborate on that. Based on my comments already, we know that aiding and abetting and conspiracy were not found. So I believe the court can then presume that the jury did not find that theory was plausible. And that theory would have to be that Mr. Gerardo Gonzalez had gone over there with Spooky and Shorty, his statement that these two other individuals were with him. If we presume that that is the position that the jury took, then we have to look at what remains, which is the lying in wait theory, which we propose is not an alternate theory to premeditation and deliberation, felony murder, and of course, premeditated and deliberate killing. And there's not a single shred of evidence whatsoever for this court to hang its hat on that there was an intentional premeditated and deliberate killing done by Mr. Gonzalez, because we do know there was a homicide. We do know that the decedent was shot and that his phone was missing, but we don't know the mechanism of exactly how that goes down. Because we have, again, Mr. Gonzalez's explanation was speaking and shorting went over there to intimidate him, that the decedent was intoxicated, fight ensued, somehow he gets shot. Very fuzzy details. So premeditation, deliberations out the door. Felony murder, I submit to the court, is out the door under a May theory, because even if the cell phone was taken after the fact, and that this court finds that there's independent corroboration of a robbery, we still have the problem with it being an after the fact taken, which would then vitiate the felony murder theory, which leads me to the lying in wait theory, and we brief this as well, but it's our position that this lying in wait theory is not something that's separate and distinct from a premeditated and deliberate killing. And our position is on that, is that what has happened in this case is there a third level of proof now, if I could submit to the court, that now has been instructed upon in the lying in wait theory. Even though we have intentional premeditated and deliberate killing, we have felony murder, and then this instruction given based on Coleman says something in between. It says, that it's watching, waiting, concealing, which we submit, there's clear evidence that he's there, lying in wait, factually. But then it goes on to say, with the intent to do substantial bodily harm for a kill, and then we take issue with the substantial bodily harm language under Coleman, that case came out right around the same time as Byford. And we believe this court should take a good look at that because that sets a different standard of proof. That is not an intentional premeditated deliberate killing, and it's not felony murder, which we know doesn't require any means of actual mechanism of injury. It can be an accident, whatever, as long as the underlying felony fits the statute. And we now have this other hybrid. And this is something that I believe the court should take a solid look at because there really can't be a specific intent to injure to get you to premeditated and deliberate killing. It just can't be the law, especially when we look at Byford and how careful the court has been about separating out specific intent, premeditation, and deliberation in terms of instructing the court. And the impetus of all this, too, is when you look at how the case was pled, there is not another conceivable theory in which the prosecution could have charged Mr. Gerardo Gonzalez. They hit him with every possible theory that they could possibly think of, and one additional theory. And then the question I would submit to the court, too, in this regard, and then what, if that is an error, lying in wait is not a separate and distinct theory. If lying in wait was improperly instructed, it's our position that that's a structural error under Cortinas, that because it sets a different burden of proof, the court doesn't even have to go into a harmless error analysis. But if it does, under Cortinas, I might submit to the court that we have covered, we believe, substantially the legal theories involved, that obviously aiding and abetting a conspiracy are out based on the jury's verdict, that intentional premeditated deliberate killing is out based on the facts just don't clarify exactly how the shooting goes down. There's never once an admission by Mr. Gonzalez that he actually shot him himself. And then we get into this in between, this line, then we get to felony murder, and the felony murder, again, is a may issue. That we can't be.
Was there any evidence presented by the state that there was some intent pre-murder to take the cell phone, maybe perhaps conceal that evidence or some sort of theory like that? Was that ever argued to the jury?
It's argued to the jury, Justice Stevens, but I'd submit to the court that that is not the actual testimony. That's not the actual evidence. Certainly it's an inference that they can make that what Mr. Gonzalez did is went kind of back and forth. It was a rather lengthy confession statement, and even though the prosecution makes reference to the fact that there was $30 taken from the victim's person at page 8 of their brief, I don't remember that ever being testified to. I looked at the reference to the record. There was a question by the detective that was unintelligible, and then they start talking about the cell phone. So I don't think there's any conclusive proof of that. They also make reference to the fact that Mr. Gonzalez admitted to bringing the gun. That's referred to in the same page of the record. That is not a correct fact. That was not testified to. In fact, on the contrary, Mr. Gonzalez had denied bringing the gun or using the gun himself, and the way he explained it was that when Spooky and Shorty returned, obviously, with the cell phone, and, from the shooting, they must have returned with the gun.
With his gun? With a gun?
Yes. Just to say that. I don't believe there's evidence that Mr. Arlotta Gonzalez ever possessed the gun whatsoever.
There's also, doesn't appear from the record, any indication that we were able to find the two colleagues that he claims were with him. Is that correct?
No. They had monikers of Spooky and Shorty. They were very common names. I pressed the detective strenuously on their inability to find that. They asked him for descriptions. He gave descriptions, and he didn't know anything other than their moniker and their descriptions, and so we did never followed through on that.
Thank you. You want to reserve the balance of your time?
I would. Thank you, Justice.
Thank you very much, Mr. McDonald.
So, McDonald, I'm particularly concerned about the lying in wait instruction and the manner in which it appears to have been given in this case. Can you help me with that?
I sure can. Thank you, Ryan McDonald, for the state. May it please the court. I will address the lying in wait a little later, unless you'd like me to address it right away.
You missed.
Okay. I just wanted to kind of put things into context because you mentioned the prosecutorial misconduct issue and the Valdez analysis, and the first prong of that, of course, is whether it was improper. The second is whether it was harmless in light of all the evidence adduced at trial. And I'd say, in this case, we have the confession. The confession is kind of, the beach house. And all of the corroborating evidence that supports that confession is kind of a scaffolding, okay? So the defendant admits to being angry at this defendant who he helped out and who was ignoring all of his numerous phone calls and text messages. He grew increasingly angry. On the night of the murder, he decides that he wants to confront this defendant. He looks for him at a mutual friend of theirs, Ricardo Manzo's house. He goes to the house and he decides there are too many people to have this confrontation now. Defendant says, well, I know the defendant's routine. The defendant's routine is on Saturday night, this was a Saturday night, to go to the Fort Cheyenne. So I'm going to go there and wait for him. He goes. goes and waits in his car, concealing himself in a dark parking lot. He eventually observes the defendant come up in a van with another person. He doesn't confront him at that time. The victim gets out of the van. There's another person there. He doesn't confront him at that time. The victim goes into the casino, spends another 40 minutes drinking. The victim had like a 0.3 blood alcohol content. Kind of stumbles out of the casino. That's the time to confront. Of course, in the admission, in the confession, he says, in the interim between going to Ricardo's house and going to Fort Cheyenne, he picks up Spooky and Shorty. He picks up Spooky specifically because he knows Spooky has a gun. What kind of gun? A .38 revolver. A black one. He tells, at some point he tells, and this looks like, it's a little confusing in the written transcript of the confession, but it looks like he tells the boys to get the fun. And I'm going to provide a cite for that, and he tells them specifically before the shooting occurs to get the cell phone. And that's 7AA1612. And that's in the transcript of his confession. So you can reference that later when you're looking at that issue. The corroborating evidence. He says that the victim was shot with a .38 revolver. No shell casings are found. The victim was shot with a .38 caliber round. The kind of gun, of course, that doesn't use shell casings is a revolver. During the confession, the defendant draws a map of the crime scene. And testimony, the crime scene analyst remarks upon how the map that the defendant draws looks exactly like the crime scene that she saw. Apparently there was a tour bus parked somewhere in between the actual casino and where the crime occurred, and the defendant puts the tour bus there accurately. There's the history of contentious relations between the defendant and the victim that come in through various witnesses, including Celestino de Lima, who testifies that he overheard the defendant, apparently he was on speakerphone, through the telephone, telling the victim, "I'm going to kill you." So, and we also have, of course, the voluminous cell phone record showing contact between the defendant and the victim that suddenly stops around the time that the victim is shot. And then, of course, the subsequent concurrence in proximity of the defendant's phone and the victim's phone after the victim is dead, where the defendant tries 25 times to access the voicemail. So that's kind of a brief overview of the evidence in this case and why it's overwhelming in the context of prosecutorial misconduct. Specifically as to the sufficiency of the evidence and the robbery count, I think it is a question of fact for the jury. There is, viewing the evidence adduced most favorable to the prosecution.
What about the $30 Mr. Reed talked about?
We basically, in the closing, said, we don't know about the $30, don't worry about the $30. What we're talking about is robbery of a cell phone. That's what we're talking about here. And that's all, when we're talking about sufficiency of the evidence for robbery, we're talking about the cell phone, not the money. Because the money was in dispute, and because of the lack of revenues, we're not sure there ever was any money. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the cell phone, and there was, according to his confession, direction to take the cell phone. And then supporting that admission, of course, is the fact that, because they raise a corpus delicti argument, which is kind of related to sufficiency of the evidence. And we might have a corpus problem in the context of robbery if the victim never had a cell phone, and there's evidence he never had a cell phone on him. But here there's both. We know that he had a cell phone. We know that he had a cell phone account. We also know that he had a cell phone on him because of a cell phone holster. And of course, as they conceded in argument, he later had that cell phone. The defendant had possession of that cell phone. So the prosecutorial misconduct issue, kind of disposing of that point by point, I've kind of already addressed the second prong of all these.
Let me go through some of these couple of issues here. The comment about travesty of justice, is that a proper comment for a prosecutor to make in closing argument?
You know, the jury is told, the last instruction is that there to look at the evidence and to do, you know, exact justice between the state of Nevada and the defendant. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the prosecutor's interest is always in justice, in justice for the defendant, in justice in maintaining the integrity of a fair trial, but also justice for the victim, justice for the people of the state of Nevada in resolving crimes. The prosecutor stated, in the context of all of this overwhelming evidence, justice demands a guilty verdict. And I think that is a proper argument. And that, and the travesty of justice in particular, would be addressed under plain error. So that would be whether it affected substantial rights. I think it's a proper argument, and it did not affect the defendant's substantial rights.
Okay, how about the comments that I think, and I'm quoting and correct me if this is wrong, about Spooky and Shorty. The state argued, quote, the one thing that you cannot, that cannot be corroborated is Spooky and Shorty. Do you think that Spooky and Shorty exists? Yeah. I mean, sarcastic comment there about that. Is that
so I think there's two steps to that. The first step was, the initial statement was, do I think Spooky and Shorty exist? They objected, the district court sustained. We rephrased. We said something to, like, does the evidence show that Spooky exists? Yes. He's over there. Spooky's the defendant. That's a proper argument. The initial one was sustained. And I would say that in argument, the defense, or plaintiff in this matter, said many of their objections were sustained. Well, the jury was specifically instructed to ignore any statement to which an objection was sustained, and we presume that they would follow that instruction. So as to any of the objections that were sustained, I don't think they affect the jury's verdict at all because of the instruction. I want to address the prey and predator issue. I think this is a proper argument because it's simply a metaphor. Because the focus was on the movements of the victim. It wasn't calling, for example, I think it's a real case that the defense cites when they say, you know, oh, calling someone a predator is a bad thing. In that case, it was a drug charge. There was no evidence of predation behavior. You know, for instance, there are cases that say it's improper to characterize someone as a thug when they're, you know, a domestic violence offender or something. But it might be proper if there's evidence that they're, you know, they are actually a thug. Okay? This case is different even from that because it's simply characterizing the movements of the victim. There was evidence that the victim was shot while he was either bending down or on his knees and that he was thrashing or trying to get away. So the metaphor that I think the prosecutor was trying to bring to mind for the jury was that of the thrashing seal or something. And the focus is really on the movements of the victim. It has nothing to do with characterizing the defendant or the defendant's behavior. And to the extent I think that it could be construed that way, and I think the district court kind of took this angle, there is evidence that the defendant engaged in predation behavior. He stalked the victim. He went to Ricardo Monza's house. He looked for a confrontation there. There were too many people. He said, I'm going to go to Fort Cheyenne and wait for him there. Waited for him there for an hour. Saw his opportunity wasn't right because he saw someone else in the van and maybe that person would help out the defendant. So we're going to wait anymore. And that is the essence of lying in wait as well. It is concealing. It's concealing not only oneself from your potential victim. It's also concealing the crime from possible view. That's the dark parking lot at the Fort Cheyenne. And concealing possibly evidence of the crime. And waiting for the perfect opportunity to strike.
Anything else?
No. If there are no questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Reed, about 2.5 minutes.
Thank you, Justice. I was lying in wait before this argument. I was concealing myself and waiting in order to stop the court so I could have this hearing. I mean, this is a very generalized term that we're using to
to get to first-degree murder. And that answered Justice Sata's question. The prosecution's entire recitation of facts, including this predator-prey argument, which is very prejudicial, centers on this line-and-wait theory that we take issue with. I think that's a very compelling argument that the court should consider.
Counsel, hasn't there been an extension of some of that language? I think it's the Moser case.
Moser's the original citation, Justice Douglas, to this particular section of the statute, and the instruction was taken from Moser, and then in Coleman it was, I guess, accepted. I mean, they didn't really address that specifically, but they talk about it in Coleman. But Coleman never addressed, Justice Douglas, how it addressed any malice. It never addressed the specific intent. And it also did not address Byford and the separation of the three and distinct instructions. The actual quote from page 1612, I happen to bring it with, was this. Did you tell your buddies to take the phone, shaking your head, yes? Yes, why did you want them to take the phone? Unintelligible reason. So he never actually even admits to it. Apparently he's shaking his head. This is not a video. It's an audio transcript in North Las Vegas. And it doesn't tell the court when that was discussed. Assuming that even him shaking your head was an admission, it doesn't let this court know, was that after the fact?
Does it say shaking his head positively or negatively?
It does say shaking your head yes, Justice
Kennedy. Okay, shaking your head yes, okay.
Yeah. So even if we presume that that's where they're getting that information from, and I believe it is, it doesn't tell us the exact timing of it. This issue about fallacy of justice, let me answer the question for you. Can you say that it's a travesty of justice if you find someone not guilty? Yes, Justice Gibbons, that is an improper argument. The court has said that repeatedly, that you can't disparage the defense theory in part, and it also is a potential burden-shifting instruction. Like, if you side with the defense, you would be committing a travesty. They can't undermine the jury's role.
But it wasn't objected to, though, that comment.
That is correct.
How do we know, and this is the problem we have in the Supreme Court on these types of arguments, how do we know it's not trial strategy? You know, you certainly have some lawyers on both sides, and they say, let's not make an issue out of this comment, but we'll fight another battle. And that's the problem we have when it gets up here.
I understand. And I can tell the court, I'm the one that was there objecting, and there was no good reason. It just got by me. There was no good reason. I should have objected. I tried to as often as I could. But if I may tie that in, please don't take that particular comment out of context. Look at all of the comments that were objected to, that were sustained in conjunction with one another, because I think that gives the court a real impression of how much misconduct occurred in this case.
Great. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Reed. Again, thank you, Mr. McConnell. We appreciate the arguments and always the excellent briefing done by both sides, and the court will be in recess to 11:30 to our court.
Thank you, Justice.